Hello and welcome to the Kids Media Club podcast. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Jo Redfern, and we're delighted to have Emily Horgan back today. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jo. Yeah, I'm back today, and we have a great guest today. I'm super excited to introduce Sophie Peachey from the News Movement. Sophie featured at the Children's Media Summit a few months ago that Andy attended, and we were so interested to hear about what the News Movement are doing with news for young people that we wanted to get Sophie on to tell us what we should be doing, because I'm sure she has far more experience in that. So you're really welcome, Sophie.
Hiya, thank you so much for having me, and it's great to meet you all.
Yeah, do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and about the News Movement, and just explain it for dummies, 101 it?
Yeah, cool. So I am Sophie, and I'm the assistant news editor and a correspondent at the News Movement. I'm 25, which might come as a bit of a surprise to the audience, I don't know, but the News Movement's all about Gen Z and how to re-engage young people with the news. There was this big Reuters digital report, which basically said that around 40% of young people actively choose to not engage with the news. So it's not like an apathy even, it's like actively being like, it's too depressing and we do not want to engage. And as we all know, you know, the news is one of the cornerstones of society, and it's important, I believe that. So our kind of business is set up around, number one, the belief that the kind of mainstream and traditional news, not that we are against the mainstream, but just a lot of the standard news organizations aren't serving young people anymore and aren't getting that engagement. And also that we just believe that young people deserve an outfit that suits them, that delivers the news to them in a like warm and relatable way and isn't too scaremongering. So that's what we do at the News Movement.
That makes sense. And what are your key platforms? Like, you know, news on TikTok is blowing up. That's something that I've seen. I've kind of been following with interest. But like, is it all TikTok? What kind of, how are you reaching your audience?
Yeah, it's funny. So we're based entirely on social media. So we're mainly on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. We've kind of had a foray into Threads when that was a thing for a little bit. Like, we do try and constantly jump onto the new platforms as and when they arise. But it's funny because a lot of people will go, oh, okay, so you have a social media presence, but where's the real thing? Like, is it your website or is there a paper? And we're like, nope. That is it. We exist completely in the ether. We exist completely on social media because our understanding or our idea is that we want to meet people where they actually are. And a lot of other news organizations, their presentation online will be the headline of an article or a video, but it's then asking you to go somewhere else to then get the content. So go behind the paywall or go onto the app if you want to read this article. Whereas we don't believe in that. People aren't leaving the app. We're just meeting people where they already are and delivering them the information in that platform in a vernacular that makes sense to them, and we don't ask them to go anywhere else.
Mm. So I have a question, and I was smiling as you were saying that. I'm going to guess that the people who ask where the real thing is, where the newspaper is or the real product, are usually the older ones, given that actually you very eloquently... Yeah, given that you very eloquently articulated something that we also see throughout kind of kids' media is that younger people are consuming across a variety of digital platforms, and that kind of the OG doesn't necessarily, it's not the OG for them at all. So given that, how do you go about gathering and reporting these news stories for a young audience, given that they don't go to newspapers or perhaps a news channel? They are everywhere. So where do you go to find stories?
So we go to, I'm trying to think of the correct word for this, like legacy media, I guess, because of course we are all employed journalists. We're all trained journalists. I was a journalist at The Independent before this job. So we all have that background, and it's not to say that we are in opposition to that kind of media. We're just alongside it. So we repackage and re-represent the same news in a different way. And I guess every morning we come in with all of our stories and we pitch them. And it might be that we've seen, you know, an article in The Independent, but it might also be that we've done our own journalism. We've been reaching out to people. But a lot of what we've seen is things that we're seeing on social media. So a lot of the conversations that we have are things that young people are actually talking about. So we totally appreciate that you know, Iran is in the media right now. And so we will probably do a global explainer on how to explain that to someone who's not really interested and doesn't know. We always talk about this concept of season one, episode one. So often when you read a news article, they might be talking about NATO and the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Houthis in the Red Sea. And you kind of, it assumes quite a lot of knowledge from somebody to already know the structure of UK politics and where the Red Sea is. And we've had comments sometimes that it seems reductive from us to say, to start with, where is the Red Sea? Like, where even is that? But we just really always try and start from season one, episode one, to a 22-year-old who isn't interested in the news, whose life doesn't play into any of this. It's just, you know, the BBC app is something that they don't have on their phone. Then we need to start right from the beginning. So that's kind of how we think about stories. We also think about doing stories, but through different lenses. So, okay, we want to talk about the climate crisis, but we know that a lot of young people get climate fatigue and don't want to be involved. So actually, Kim Kardashian's done this new clothing line and she's giving 10% of her profits to a climate charity. And it might seem reductive to a different audience, but that's not who we're trying to serve. We're trying to serve the young person who knows who Kim Kardashian is and doesn't know what the UN is. And that's how we operate.
That's great. I mean, that's a kind of a really, that turns on its head, I think, the way a lot of people approach news reporting, which is you start from the user and then you kind of work out how to kind of a bridge then to the news content. Does your approach, your content strategy approach change depending on whether it's TikTok or whether it's YouTube and Instagram? Could you explain a bit about how you kind of approach each of those different platforms and how the context changes the content, really?
Yeah, of course. So we have an audience team that really helps us with that. And they've been able to genuinely dissect what performs on different platforms because it is actually quite widely varied. So for example, on TikTok, that's big conversations, that's international explainers, diverse stories, that does really well. Instagram tends to favor more like, we call it health, I'm going to get a lisp when I try and say this, health, self, wealth. So that's kind of more inspirational things, slightly more female leaning, maybe like fashion stories. We have different areas in which we specialize. So for example, life and style, that vertical does really well on Instagram. But we know that on TikTok, those kind of like big conversations that are happening right now. So, you know, OJ Simpson dies, that's already got a million views on our TikTok account. And then on YouTube, there's Shorts. So Shorts also does really well with global explainers. So elections happening in South Korea, stuff like that does really well. There was a video of a New Zealand MP doing the hacker in Parliament. And I think that got about 13 million views and continues to get about 500,000 views a day. And then on our main page for YouTube, we then have our original investigations and that's longer form. So YouTube likes being fed kind of meatier, longer bits of work. So it's super interesting to see how different things perform on each platform and actually how you can work to it. Because I guess if you were a print journalist and you're writing an article, you just write the one article and it goes out. Whereas on social media, you have to constantly be strategizing about where you're going to place it and what time of the day and what the SEO is, what does the metadata look like? It's a kind of whole gamut.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you guys, it sounds like there's a real global English speaking audience at the very least. Is that who you're trying to get? Or is there more kind of regionality to it than that?
We have a big following in Turkey. I guess it depends because sometimes you do stories about, I don't know, the Turkish earthquake and then you get a huge amount of following from that region. But we're based in London and the US. So it's an interesting question, actually, because it's something that we need to like constantly be pulling ourselves up on because it's, and that's something I'd speak to you from your question before about like, how do we news gather? We are all young. The average age of our newsroom is 25. So you are picking up already because that's your life on stories that pertain to your demographic. Really hard is trying to constantly cater to an international audience whilst being a team of 12 in London, for example, or a team in New York. So having to really school ourselves and be rigorous in, like, are we doing enough? Are we representing people enough? You know, where are elections happening in the world? What are things that we're not keyed into? Because we actually have a pretty global audience and we don't just want to be catering to 25-year-olds in London that look and sound like me.
I was just wondering, you know, you've spoken about how different types of news content work across those different platforms, which makes perfect sense. Just flipping that and putting the news consumer at the center of it, have you spotted any trends as to how do they interact with you, news? Do they tend to have a single platform and they stick with that one, or do they seamlessly move across platforms? Are there times when they do want that deeper dive, for example, and you spoke about that on YouTube, and then are there other times that they dip into it on TikTok? And again, you know, we grew up watching the news once a day. You got your one hit either at 6 o'clock or at 10 o'clock. Do you find that actually young people are consuming news at all different times? What are the big changes that our listeners might not be aware of that you've observed being in this space?
I think you're so right. Like, you don't actually know. You can try and collect audience data on, like, at what times in the day are people on Instagram and stuff, but you don't know who's using Instagram above TikTok and where they're moving to. I mean, you can make assumptions that a long form piece of content on YouTube is not getting watched in the middle of the day because most people are at work or school. Mm. So that's something that people are watching in the evening when they're eating their dinner or have time. You can make those assumptions and you can look at data. The thing that's fascinating actually is that you can kind of be as across it as you would like and have made assumptions and have used data to kind of make your guesses slightly more educated. But we are totally at the whim of the algorithms that are not owned by us. So we work on, I guess that's been the really hard difference, is that if you're writing a broadsheet, you own that website, you can see all the data, and you control every aspect of it. Whereas for us, we have almost no control. And this is not to speak negatively to the platforms, but we just don't have much control over, you know, what time of the day are they pushing out our content? Are they pushing out our content at all? We've had encounters with TikTok where, because they've got very good regulation, especially like with children, then words like war, bomb, sex, yeah, you know, all of that kind of tags the video and it gets downgraded. And that's really tricky because we're a news platform. Mm. And obviously it makes sense because they're trying to protect young people from seeing dodgy things online, but then it's hard for us. So your question is interesting because we do our best, but again, it's difficult operating on platforms where we don't ultimately control the algorithms or what people are seeing.
I can totally see that. I mean, one of the things that I think will really surprise our listeners is just in that comment that you just made there, is that I think a lot of people assume that TikTok wouldn't be the most rigorous in terms of pulling stuff down and having keywords that were kind of blocking content, that they'd assume that in some ways, that because TikTok's kind of become a bit of a poster boy for kind of the evils of social media. What other aspects are there of kind of social media where you feel like the preconceptions of those platforms are wrong or kind of aren't accurate in your experience? So because you're saying that actually your experience is that TikTok is the more kind of rigorous in terms of regulating content, is that right?
TikTok is very rigorous. I'm nervous. I don't want to libel them. There are huge, like, they have they have multiple rungs of content. What's the word I'm looking for? Moderation. Some of that includes humans sat in London. I know people whose job that is. So I think that is a bit of a misconception about TikTok. Again, the problem is that what you see on TikTok is not what someone else sees. The algorithm is so highly developed. It's so attuned to who you are and your interests that who knows what other people are seeing. But I think a big thing that I hear a lot is about misinformation online, and that TikTok's just kind of this deluge of, just a deluge of misinformation and things that are not factually accurate. I think X is worse, right, for that, to be honest. And you can see all the different platforms putting in, kind of putting their stamp on how to target misinformation. So X, or Twitter, as some of your viewers may know it as, now have the community notes section where they can kind of say this is not factually accurate. I mean, did you see the Conservatives? It was a video about how London is like one of the most unsafe cities in the world. And they put this video out, the Conservative Party on Twitter, and underneath it was like, this is inaccurate, and that is also footage of New York, not London. Stuff like that is great. But yeah, I think on TikTok, you hear the fear-mongering, and I totally appreciate, especially for parents, how that can be really scary because you've got just this like unfettered access to corners of the internet. But at the same time, you've also got unfettered access to corners of the internet that are trying to help you learn. You've got platforms like ours, which are actually the antidote to misinformation. So you've got people, you've got swathes of people trying to fight back, and you've got really great stuff on there. And it's so worldly. I mean, the way in which it's connected all areas of the globe, the way in which it just expands people's horizons. I think that, as with all things, it's kind of what you choose to take from it.
Yeah.
And on our end, given that we work, I'm pretty sympathetic, and I think it's probably a good thing. Do I know what a kid is seeing on their TikTok account? No, I don't.
Yeah. TikTok is such a, it's such an innovation, right? Like, and it's obviously grown in the last 5 years exponentially, and just the application of it is constantly changing. But it does, I can't imagine in that they are trying to stay at the forefront of all that change, you know, whereas the older platforms are nearly trying to adapt to kind of stimulate that change, you know, to stimulate the kind of the fairly viral behavior that you're seeing on that you see on TikTok for loads of different content types. Yeah, no, that would make complete sense. I mean, from your perspective, like, what are your friends, are the people around you consuming the news movement? Like, where are the places that people are getting their news that you're seeing? I mean, for me, Matter of Fact, I don't know, on TikTok, she's like the royal family bat signal woman, where she comes up and anything, and obviously all the things that have been going on with Kate Middleton and recently, and she comes on with this, she's kind of this woman from the States, and she comes on always really considered. She doesn't term herself a royal commentator. Anyway, I'm totally on her talk. I don't even follow her, but I'm totally on her talk. But like, she presents herself as a really credible person, and I believe, you know, everything she says seems to come with the right context that leads me to believe that she's credible. I mean, what are the places that young people are getting their news from these days? Is there a new frontier of the face of news, even with organizations like the News Movement?
A lot of my friends have told me that they only get their news from the News Movement, for good or for bad. Yeah. Because I think that a big thing happened, especially with the pandemic, where most young people I know would get their news from push notifications, maybe from Sky, maybe from the BBC. And having that on your home screen, especially during the onset of the war in Ukraine and then COVID, like that era of time, it was just constant, like, oh God, okay, everyone's dying, brilliant. This is dread. And I think that people are increasingly wanting to follow places like the News Movement where they can still stay informed. I always like to think about it in kind of terms of like, unless you're a political nut or you have a job that means that you need to be incredibly worldly and knowledgeable, most people just kind of want to be able to hold court at a dinner party. And when someone says something about Israel, they kind of want, I know that sounds incredibly reductive, but I actually think it's probably true that like most people just kind of want to know briefly what's going on and kind of like the main summary. It's like the Sparks Notes almost, not saying that we're the Sparks Notes of news, but people want to know the summary, but are they doing deep dives? Like some people are, but like a lot of people aren't. So yeah, a lot of my friends get their news from the News Movement. There are other similar accounts online. That people go to. The thing that concerns me more probably is the big rise in journofluencers, which are basically people like the woman that you've just stated who, and again,
journofluencers, that's a new one, amazing.
Writing it down. I'm not defaming this lady because I don't know her credentials, but I guess at the News Movement we're all qualified journalists, you know, we've the people that started our company used to be the editorial director for the BBC and the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal. So we have rigor, like we sit in a newsroom, and even though the presentation of what we do is on TikTok, the process, the due process that goes before it, we have lawyers, we, you know, it's proper journalism. It's just the packaging is different. And I think that my concern is that you get these big journo-fluencers who might be doing a really good job. And like, what is journalism? Journalism ultimately is just, you know, explaining what's going on in the world. But I worry that some of these people who aren't, don't have any legal eyes over what they're doing and have huge followings, potentially, you know, that's slightly more misleading when it comes to misinformation. And I think that is really what we're actually working against. It's that kind of, it's individuals.
That's interesting.
Yeah, with that in mind, I was just wondering, just to expand on that, does that mean that you also feel a responsibility, or indeed, are there any resources that you put out on maybe kind of explaining to young people what to do in that situation, as in check your sources, maybe think about what's the motivation for this particular person or journo-fluencer giving me this information. Is there something behind it that maybe they're trying to sell me something? You know, that actually educating young people on how to consume news rather than actually impart the news itself, which you obviously do very well.
We've attempted that. Like we've tried it, and there are certain scenarios. Like if you're doing a story on, like I do lots of stuff on deepfakes, for example, then obviously it pertains to the story that you would then also maybe like link through to some kind of resource, or you might explain how to detect a deepfake. But what we try not to do is to be paternal or maternal, because we have majority female. We try not to be too paternal. We try not to be too patronizing. And I think that we've kind of realized that the best thing to do is just to be a good role model, is like to be the example of people doing it well. Yeah. And we are the antithesis to any fake news you're getting online. Because we try. And as I said, like in certain scenarios, like we do link through, like we did stuff with, there was a lot of footage coming out after the October 7th attack at the Nova Festival, where a lot of the footage just wasn't real. So, you know, we do try and talk about that. But I think when we talk about young people are, you know, it's a different generation with a different mindset. But I think there's like a certain patronization that happens with young people. Like most 25-year-olds I know are like working in the civil service, and like, you know, they're not, they don't want to feel patronized, like they don't know what's going on. And actually, like, do I worry that my mum's more likely to get misinformation on Facebook? Probably than my friends. Sorry, I'm digging myself a bit of a...
I totally get that. And I think it goes back to what you were saying about taking the news to where your audience is already. You don't want it to feel too top down to say, here's what you should be thinking about this, because people's defenses just come up and then they stop listening to you, really. But in terms of the content that you're creating, how do you ensure that the reporting is accurate and reliable from your perspective? What kind of processes do you have in place for that, really?
Before I answer that, I was just going to pick up on the one thing that you said, which is funny because we always say our mission is not to tell people what to think. It is to help them to think and to give them the information that they need to think about the things that they want to think about. So I think you put that really well. What are our processes? I think just like really similar to any other news organization. I mean, we have access to wires. There are certain organizations that kind of need to have, like, for example, when OJ Simpson died, sorry that I've used that as an example twice, just in my mind. But when OJ Simpson died, even if the New York Post writes about it, we wait until the Associated Press confirms it, because that is like, you know, they are incredibly non-partisan and non-biased news organization. And so we kind of like have main organizations that we use their wire information. We have structures of hierarchy. We have sub-editing. We have our editor-in-chief who will oversee our work to make sure it's all accurate. If we feel like there is a legal element to something that we've written, we get it legaled with our lawyer. And then also, everyone here is a trained journalist. It's kind of just like how we've learned, I guess. But I think that those are things that, small things about how the world of news works that perhaps individuals with successful accounts might, and I don't want to make assumptions, but might not have those processes in place, or even have other people in the newsroom. Like, a lot of how things work in general is just asking someone next to you, hey, does this look right? Can you double check that? And it, when people are working on their own, you do worry a bit that those processes aren't necessarily being followed. But again, can't speak on behalf of different people.
But I totally get that. You're kind of saying that when you've got a single journalist or what was the word you used for the kind of the influencer?
Journalist.
Yeah, I don't even know if I'd be able to say that. But I completely get that description. And I think that there's a danger that any biases don't get challenged because it's just one person and they kind of double down on that. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, you're also facing like multiple things on social media where it's like people just really like a person because they might like what they're wearing or they think their house looks cool. So like there is a lot of aspects that you're combating that aren't just like the delivery of the news and a lot of visual elements that you have to think about. So it can be, it can be tricky.
Does it mean that it's making your job even harder to be impartial? You know, impartiality is something that you've spoken about and you know, trying to present the world and the facts as they are. When we are in this age of attention grabbing and polarizing and getting ever more sensationalized in order to grab attention and eyeballs across these social media platforms, what's impartiality to you and to young people nowadays?
I guess impartiality is that we never editorialize when it comes to world news. And we don't enter into quote unquote culture wars. So, you know, gender, puberty blockers with young trans kids. It's all discourse. It's upsetting. It's not something that we feel like we would ever editorialize on. So the way that we present our information is totally factual. It will be, you know, we go through our processes and there's no bias. Obviously the difficulty is that once it goes out into the world, people have a lot to say.
Yeah.
And something, for example, so when the attack happened in at the Nova Festival, we were like, right, how do you be impartial when it comes to something like this, such an incredibly polarizing and almost philosophical very kind of protracted conflict. Like, it's like the ultimate thing that people would accuse people of not being partisan on. So we basically decided to do it on a numerical point system. So for every Israeli voice that we would platform a Gazan voice, and kind of like back and forth like that, so that you just, because it's not just like in the story itself, it's in the delivery across the board. Like, that's how Ofcom works, right? Like, it's not just what GB News is saying, but it's also what ITV is saying and how the kind of like day looks. So that's what we try and do. Obviously you get the problem, which is that people's algorithms are highly developed. So some people only see certain kinds of content. So my sister texted me and said, I've only seen TNM do pieces about like that seem sympathetic towards Gaza. And I was like, but that's all that's been fed to you. If you go on our feed, you'll actually see that it's very different, but that's just what you're picking up. So that's really tricky. I guess, within a video, impartiality is, in my mind, like, makes a lot of sense, I guess, across the broad spectrum of what you output. That can be harder to achieve only because people don't see it.
Yeah, and that must be a real challenge to try and navigate those algorithms. Because actually, I hadn't thought about that till you'd said that. That in some way, sometimes people end up following stuff that they disagree with, weirdly. And then they end up getting fed more of that stuff. So it gives them the impression that it's very one-sided and biased in terms of its reporting. Is there any particular way you can navigate that, or are you just totally in the hands of the platform's algorithms?
Well, I think we just have to keep our side of the street clean. And if people have things to say, like, I guess it's just very public. You can see it off on TikTok. Like, when people are commenting, you're reading them. It's not like someone's reading their newspaper at home and being like, oh, that's rubbish. But they're going to tell us that.
Yeah.
But you kind of just have to be confident in your journalistic rigor and be like, you know, they haven't seen the rest of our content, and you know, they can have any opinion that they like, but we feel like we are keeping our side of the street clean and we know what we're doing. We hope we know. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then in terms of content subjects and all that kind of thing, Sophie, like, is there subjects that pop for younger audiences that you think would surprise old people like us?
There is actually a lot of engagement around politics. I think that's always quite interesting. Like, when a clip from PMQs does really well, or stuff about Rishi Sunak, that always surprises me a little bit.
Adidas Sambas.
Exactly like that performed really well for us. And you sometimes think, I don't know. But we have had, so our editorial director, Rebecca Hudson, she's kind of come in and looked at our audience and what they're interested in and what we were doing. And we've now split our content, because we have like really clear verticals now. So we do life and style, we do arts and entertainment, we do sex and relationships, and then we do news, like hard news, global explainers. And that's kind of what we do. So, you know, we don't do tech, we don't do food, etc. And I think that's been really useful to see what people care about. People really care about online trends. I guess that would be the kind of thing that would surprise maybe my parents, because these are trends happening on a platform, and then you're talking about the trend on the platform. It's all very like meta and kind of, yeah, very encapsulated within that one platform. But that always does really well. And I think the other thing that's really surprises me is that people really do want to know. Like, we did this video about everything that's like happening in Congo at the moment, and the Congolese football team kind of did this protest during the Africa Cup of Nations, and that just popped off. People have such an appetite for things that are happening around the world, and I think Gen Z is really like, injustice hits them really hard. So there are lots of, it's not all just like, yeah, TikTok trends and, there's a lot of like really in-depth world news that's just, if you position it in the right way and explain it with enough clarity and no patronization or patronizing, the people are really, really involved and invested.
Yeah. And I get that whole, like, what you said about season one episode one really spoke to me. I mean, I think you can apply, that is not a Gen Z thing. I think that should be applied everywhere. And it's like, yes, it's important to be able to speak about something at a dinner table, but equally when you start looking to vote, right, on something, there was a referendum in Ireland, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and you're just like, you're just trying to get like, why should I care about this? What does this mean? What does the detail of this mean? It was tough. It was tough to find that detail. People are already like 75 steps down the conversation, and, you know, somebody who hasn't been following it in detail just wants to kind of get caught up when that's whether you want to vote or you want to make a car purchase. I know you're not saying you cover that kind of thing, but it's like, okay, just show me it from the start. So I kind of understand the kind of what I'm working within here.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I was looking at, I won't say which party, one of the British political parties, I was on their social media, and they're doing like all this meme content and like trying to be like young and cool. And all the comments were like, what are your policies? Like, what do you stand for? Like, we get it. Like, you hate the Tories or you hate Labour. Like, we understand that. You've got this infighting. But, like, what are we voting for? And that's kind of, like, where we come in, where it's like, okay, when we approach the elections, like, how do we actually, what do young people genuinely care about? Like, do they care about the Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak hate? No, they care about what are your actual policies. So I think that season one, episode one stuff is so, like, I think about that every day. And I remember going to a conference in Greece. Gosh, it's very windy. I don't know if you can hear that. I went to a conference in Greece a year and a half ago, and we were talking about what we did at the News Movement, and we were like obviously a lot smaller back then. And I think I was talking about, I was saying the season one, episode one thing, and I said something about, you know, lots of people don't even know who the Chancellor of the Exchequer is or what that job even means. And some CEO bigwig was like, that all sounds incredibly reductive. And I was like, but that's an attitude that turns people off. Like, yeah. If number one, you're 50, you're incredibly successful, you run in circles where I'm sure you're all talking about them. Like, you're just not our target audience on any level. And even if you think it's reductive for your child, it's not, because someone has to explain these things. Like, the reason that people get turned off the news is because they open it and they immediately feel completely out of their depth, and like no one's bothered to explain to them, like, at what point in your life were you just kind of meant to, like, via osmosis, know about every militia or faction in the Middle East? Like, unless you have a genuine interest, how are you knowing that information? Someone has to step in and help you, guide you through life. Like,
but there's times sometimes where you need to refer back. Do you know what I mean? Like, you might have picked up a subject a couple of years ago, blah blah blah, and it's suddenly back relevant, and you're again, and you're like, hang on a second, who are they, and why do I care, and why, you know, and having that refresher course, because it can't all stay in the brain. Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, sometimes, and everyone's an expert in something and completely ignorant about something else. You've got to kind of start from somewhere, really.
Someone said to me once that, which I think is very true, that a lot of news articles on certain websites are kind of written for the London metropolitan elite, and they use big words, and it's so that they can go to the pub together and be like, oh, I really liked your use of the word ostensible, or, you know, it's for each other. It's not actually for, or in my opinion, like, it's not actually for other people, it's kind of for that echo chamber. And I just think it's actually really important. And what I love that we do is it's not for us. Like, it's for us in the sense that we are the same age as the people that we're kind of trying to serve. So it's a good kind of like weather test to be like, if I'm interested in this, then maybe other people my age will be too. But like, this is for the audience. Like, we're not serving ourselves, we're serving other people. So we don't care if it might seem reductive to some 50-year-old CEO.
Yeah.
Because it's what young people care about.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'm so aware of this.
You can't hear it on our end.
No. But it's interesting what you point out, because it plays into something that is not just exclusive to news. And we speak about a lot on this podcast and in our daily lives in terms of this authenticity. You have to build your product, whether it's a new animated series or it's news, around your audience. Like you say, you know, no longer do we work top down. Actually, you could argue we now should work the other way around. We go to them first. We figure out what they like, how they like it presented, and when they like it presented. And we build for that. Like you say, check the ego at the door, and actually that is the way that young people want to be served any type of content. And, you know, I did chuckle a little bit. You know, the one thing that I do love about young people, and to your point about being patronized, is you can't pull the wool over their eyes. They have got the best filter for when something is disingenuous. So when a political party or whomever, a studio or network, is trying to speak in their language, in air quotes, they see straight through it. That's kind of classic boomer behavior. So it's great that you have pulled out, actually, that is exactly the way that you create news that resonates for young people. So with that in mind, tell us how your vision of a news network of the future looks like. What's ahead for you?
I think it looks, not to plug us too hard, but I think it probably looks something quite similar to this. I think that there's always been big changes in society, and people have always had some level of resistance to them because people don't like change. And when people have created great business models out of things that have worked before, then it's hard to reconcile the fact that it's no longer working. But I guess that when the advent of like 24-hour news came along on the TV, the content doesn't change. It's still news, but the distribution changes because now it's moving on to television, and you have to think about that, how that works. The problem with social media, like we spoke about before, is that it's not just like, okay, the news is now on social media. It's like, which social media and where and by who? And there's so much competition that, you know, to go back to that point about like serving your audience, of course, we're not going to let our audience dictate exactly what we do. But if you're being snooty about certain subjects that you don't think are like journalistic enough, then like they'll go somewhere else. And there's so many brilliant people and brilliant organizations in the world that are trying to create new visions of what it means, trying to innovate and pioneer in the news space. And I think those words are almost like an oxymoron when it comes to the news, because the news is a product that is factual, and it's not, you can't, how do you innovate in that realm? Like, it's not art or it's not television. But the distribution method changes. Like, I don't know when DVDs came along and then it went into streaming, and like everyone's always like, no, I'm not gonna, it's like the world moves, the platforms change, you kind of just have to get on board with it. So I think something like our news organization, which is just very flexible, it's very hybrid, we're constantly looking to what the next thing is. I think those are the organizations that are going to end up kind of carving out a place in the future, because the refusal of other places to move or change, their audiences are dying. It's a fact.
It is a fact. Yeah, that's great.
Hear, hear.
Super. Do you know what? I'm filled with hope, actually. I'm filled with hope that, you know, young people are going to be okay. You know, I find I've got two teenage boys, and they come to me to ask about subjects and topics related to what's happening in the world, you know, and they show far more interest than I ever did. And that actually is really encouraging. And I don't profess to know all the answers, but in a way, it's great that they're curious. And it's great that we've got people like you that are there helping them figure this stuff out. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I was just going to say, it reminds me of one of the things that really stuck with me from your session at the Children's Media Summit, was when you said, we can't hammer a 20th century solution on a 21st century audience. And I think you had a really good handle on what that audience wants and is looking for. So that's great.
I also, thank you. And I was just going to say one last thing about Gen Z, as I think I firmly believe this, like Gen Z's got a really bad rap. Like it's, you know, it's media organizations. I mean, the amount of like articles I see about Gen Z written by people who are distinctly not Gen Z about how lazy we all are. And I think that, you know, I don't worry so much for the future, because I think like your sons, like Gen Z, are so curious and so engaged. It's just a totally different world. I mean, how are you motivating people who will never buy a house, who are materially earning less than their parents, who will never be as successful as their parents, who don't have any of the motivators that existed before, you know, who are facing the downfall of, you know, the climate crisis and a incoming massive refugee crisis, you know, looking down the barrel of almost apocalypse, that's what we're told. You know, it's a different, we're growing up in a different age with social media. So I think that Gen Z do care. It's just about finding those 21st century solutions.
Yeah, and it's like when they have the curiosity that an organization like yours exists to kind of satisfy it, and then because that just breeds more curiosity, more interest, and that kind of thing, and they're not being met with, or not, like none of us are being met with, you know, broadsheets that are using big words that their friends want to use in the pub in London, you know, that there's actual content and it's right.
Just saying that, like, oh, young people don't sit down and watch the 6 and 10 news anymore. It's like, yeah, but that doesn't mean they're not interested in the world. It just means that one distribution has stopped working.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
I mean, and there's a sense that when people lament that people aren't watching Blue Peter in the same numbers, there's a kind of a question about, well, is it relevant to that audience anymore? And it's really
someone at the summit came up to me afterwards, because I'd said about, I felt like we were all kind of skirting around that subject slightly, particularly on Blue Peter. And I think, I don't know if you remember, Andrew, but at the end I was just kind of like, I think we can talk about the landscape and the mediascape, but I think also if something's not doing well anymore, it might just be that it's not very, like, change it. Maybe it's not very good and maybe people aren't interested anymore. And I think that that's something that I kind of think about a lot. It's not that, like, curiosity as a concept has just bypassed Gen Z. That's not true. It's not just that the ways in which people think it should be done suddenly aren't so interesting anymore. And it's like, you just have to come up with new ways.
Mm. 100%.
Absolutely.
This has been fascinating. Congratulations on doing something amazing. I'm absolutely in awe, and I can see why Andy was messaging Emily and I from the summit saying, we really need to speak to Sophie. So thank you for joining us.
He was literally at the summit. Andy was like, we got to get her on. I got to give her a shout. Hopefully she's going to be open to it. So thank you. Yeah.
And thank you guys for being so interested, because it's always so nice to, like, see the interest from, like, beyond these four walls. So that's just really means a lot. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's all we have time for on today's episode of the Kids Media Club podcast. Hope you enjoyed the show. Do us a favor and subscribe and follow if you haven't done so already. It all helps. Join us next time as we dive into another kids-related topic. See you then.